Hello, everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ramsey Paul.
Hey, it's good to be back.
So your recent one is it's called Post-Racial Elite Can Freedom and Nationalism Mix? And the basis of it is this article up on AMREN called Post-Racial Elite. I guess, first of all, explain what the article on American Renaissance is about.
That article on American Renaissance was about how that multiracial kids of white and Asian couples tend to do better financially than just children of white couples. And the guy was arguing, or actually the guy was Jewish, I think, but he was arguing that that's the future. You know, there's not going to be race in the future, and you need to get with the program and intermarry and all that type of stuff. So that was kind of the debate. And he used Japan as an example that's kind of backwards because they have strict immigration controls. So he doesn't see a future for them. So I just kind of did a video explaining my thoughts on that topic because personally, I'm very much a libertarian. I don't care what people do as long as it doesn't impact me. But at the same time, I'm a nationalist. I believe in borders.
Oh, you're saying you get people writing to you and like they're talking about like whether you're okay with them like dating some girl or they're asking you like you're some advice columnist and
yeah, I know. Hey, I'm a compliment. I'm like Dear Abby, right, of the alternate right wing. So yeah, they asked me like, well, hey, I'm in love with this Iranian girl. Is it okay if I marry her? And I'm like, well, what do I know? First of all, that's assuming that Iranians are white people, and I don't really care about that. And even if I care about that, how am I going to stop that? Right? People are going to do what they're going to do. I think the key is to have a strong borders and strong immigration policies, which help maintain the culture identity. Because as someone once wrote, if you ever have social interaction, you're probably going to have sexual intercourse eventually, right? Because people tend to find their soulmates like that happen to live real near them. It's amazing how that happens. So if you control your country with immigration, you really don't have a problem with losing your culture and so forth, and you don't have to worry about it on a micro level. That's why on a micro level, I don't really care about who dates who or anything like that or race issues. I care about it more on a macro level of a country, keeping a country cohesive and maintaining the culture.
But the thing about America today is that that's obviously not the case.
No, it was the case, though. You know, for like 200 years, we were about 90% white. And then after the 1965 Immigration Act, with its Ted Kennedy pushed through, and at the time, people, you know, objected to that. And he said, no, don't worry. It's not going to change the demographic balance of this country at all. So put those silly fears aside. And it turned out it didn't really happen that way. And especially it's accelerated recently, especially with Mexican immigrants, which I have nothing against Mexican immigrants. I don't have anything against anyone in the world, but they have a country called Mexico, and I want to preserve our country, not because I'm a supremacist, just like Japanese would like to keep their country Japanese, not because they hate other people. It's just we want our own culture. So that's what really changed the demographic balance in this country. And it really allows us so we don't have self-determination anymore, which is a sad thing.
What are some of the responses that you've gotten from this position so far?
Well, it's mixed. Some people like me, some don't. Like I've often stated, because everyone seems to think, even though I've said this many times, I'm not a white nationalist, but they assume I am. And the reason I'll kind of repeat why I'm not a white nationalist is I think nationalism is for all people, not just for whites, number one. And the other point is nationalism is much more than just race. And I use an example historically of France and Germany, even though historically they're white people, they have totally different languages, cultures, religions, whatever. And that's fine. That's why we have nations. I think the more nations we have, the better, because people can have the culture that they like to live in. And in the case of America, we were never 100% white nation anyway. We were historically always around 90%, which I think is fine, and I consider all those people that are in America to be Americans. I don't differentiate based on race, but I also realize race matters, and you can only have a certain percentage and still maintain your self-identity. So that's where I get on a macro level. I think we need to protect our, or we should have, and if we go forward in the future, get a new country, protect our national identity through immigration controls. And but on a micro level, it's just silly to try to worry about who has babies with who. And people always bring up, well, you know, we should ban interracial marriage. And I'm like, are you living in 1955? People can have
sex
outside of marriage.
Well, but you're pretty libertine.
It doesn't
matter.
You've even
done shows about zoosexual marriage.
That's right. I was making fun of those gay marriages and stuff. Yeah, but no. So I don't really I don't really care about that. And I'm a little. And actually, that's a good analogy that I thought about. And people will misunderstand that, but it's sort of like homosexuality used to be in the 50s. It existed, but at the same time, it wasn't promoted. And you'd have a couple guys that were, everyone would say, oh boy, they're confirmed bachelors and they sure seem to be having a happy time together, you know, but no one really cared, right? Because it didn't really impact the culture. In the same way, I think that happens if you have a 90% ethnically balanced country. It doesn't matter if it's Japan or Germany or America. It really doesn't matter if some people of other races want to come together. In my opinion, I know the strict white nationalists say it has to be 100% pure, whatever that means.
Yeah, their goal is, I know there's different separatist movements. There's like the Northwest migration, and they're very much, they have a strong emphasis on 100%.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. And I'm just in the real world. And I use real world examples. I don't.
Here in LA, we're down to like a quarter. I mean, I'll be honest. I'd even be happy if 70%.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I bring up. I have so many people that are white nationalists. I don't say anything bad about those guys, but they seem to have an attitude unless it's 100% or nothing. They'd rather have nothing versus 100, you know, versus, let's say, 90%. That's not acceptable. But in the real world, not just the fantasy world of the internet, I talk to people in the real world, you're going to have a tough sell of just having this whole racial purity discussion. If, for example, do you exclude someone that's 1/8 Indian? Or, you know, or what if like a couple should have adopted a Korean girl and she's in the family now and she grows up, she's like every other kid, she gets along with everyone, she speaks English. Are you going to say, no, you can't be in our country because you have a Korean daughter? That's just absurd, and most normal Americans are not going to care about that. Now, they do care about, they don't want 100,000 Somalis just flood their neighborhoods and schools, and for obvious reasons. But they don't care about a more sane immigration policy.
You sort of advocate a maintaining the current ethnic composition. You say, like, at the status quo via immigration. You mentioned sort of the number 90%, but I mean, right now, I think it's about 60%. So you're talking about America as it exists or some hypothetical future country?
Yeah, ideally, we would have kept it that way. In 1965, it was 90%, and if we didn't change our Immigration Act, it would have stayed that way. Obviously, we don't have a time machine, so we can't do that. But if we ever get a country, because I think in the future, the union is going to break apart, and I would advocate if we do start having a new nation, that we do have immigration controls on it that's reasonable, that people can get behind. And I think most people could support that versus an absolute position where they get into these silly debates about racial purity that no one in the real world really cares about.
You describe yourself as a libertarian nationalist. You sort of do your own thing. You're not really interested in appeasing either side, because you're saying is like you're pretty popular among the white nationalists, but there's a few of them that like, oh, they think that Ramsey Paul has yellow fever because you did some article a while back. But on the other hand, the libertarians, some of the libertarians don't like you because of the nationalism.
Yeah, and it's funny you said that because I just got my death threat again from a white nationalist today. I think I probably get more threats by them than I do Jews. So it's kind of funny how that works out because you know, who knows, a really white nationalist. There's a lot of trolls. But, yeah, a lot of people get very angry about my positions because I don't take the white nationalist point of view, which I never claim to be one. I'm just me. I'm Ramsey Paul. And I can just be me because I'm not running for a political party and I don't try to appease any group because I'm not part of any group. Any group that have me probably have a lot of trouble. So I'm just a guy that with the camera gives my views. I just consider myself an American, so I don't really worry about who I piss off, really. But I just say my views, you know, my videos are just my opinion and they're entertainment, and people don't agree with it. That's okay. I change my mind a lot anyway. So, but to me, that just seems rational because that's kind of the history of America, of having a nation, but within the nation having a lot of liberty.
I think the key thing is there's this issue of a freedom, the issue of liberty, but then there's also the issue of have the media. If you're sort of opposed to other people's lifestyle, you're almost like that. That's a very taboo position to take. So I think a part of freedom is also is having the freedom to express a disapproval.
Oh, absolutely. I'm for freedom of association, and I'm for the traditional American way that if you, let's say, you have a restaurant and you want to exclude redheaded people, in my opinion, that's your business. You should have the right to do that. So I'm for people being able to have freedom of association. And so in that way, I have the traditional conservative approach.
Those are the two big things you advocate are the immigration policy and the freedom of association. You're critical of people who advocate policies that really sort of infringe on people's like liberty too much in regards to some of the racial issues.
Well, yeah, there's two points. One, I disagree with it philosophically, but number two, it's just unrealistic. It's not going to work. If you have people that are living together, they're going to get together socially and probably make babies together. That's going to happen. And you can, you know, prohibit it in marriage laws, but you know, now that's kind of a dated concept. Like most African American women don't even get married and they have plenty of children. So that's, and that's changing a lot with white people too. So that's kind of a dated concept. So the only way that you could possibly do that is to have, let's say, a 100% racially pure state. And I think in the real world, that will be a tough sell because that was never the case in America. And that's not really our tradition. And most people, normal people really don't care if they move into a neighborhood. They want to make sure it's a nice neighborhood. And that's pretty much a code word we all know for a white neighborhood, right? But at the same time, if someone says, oh, yeah, this is an all-white neighborhood, but that couple down there, they have a little Korean girl they adopted, you know, most people are going to go, oh, well, I don't care. Big deal. So that's that. You got to have the flexibility of not trying to maintain the 100% pure position. It's kind of the old saying, you can't let perfection be the enemy of good. And what that means is you can't be so pure and so want so perfection that you prevent something better from happening. So I'm and philosophically, I don't have a problem with that either of other people because I'm not against other races or other groups. And so that doesn't really bother me. But at the same time, I want to have self-determination. And to have self-determination, you have to have a certain percentage of the population that's homogeneous, which the United States was. Just look at old movies from the 50s, 40s, or 30s. It was a pretty much a Christian white nation. No one really thought much about it. But it was never 100%, and they didn't have an issue with that.
That's the thing. I mean, I'm pretty flexible because I kind of told you my background is I went to a public high school in L.A. where a lot of times, like, I mean, there was no – many of the cases, there was no other white student in the entire – classroom, so I consider myself fairly flexible, but I think the sort of the dichotomy is basically this: you're either a white nationalist who wants 100% white nation, or you're on the other side and you're totally fine with the whites becoming a small minority, and there's sort of no room for flexibility, and I think that's kind of how it's kind of set up in a sense. The propaganda. How the mainstream media says you're either a racist or you're not a racist, and there's just no room for gray area.
Yeah, part of that's on the internet is mostly the loudest people are the freaks, really. And because I've
listened to some of Tom Metzger's speeches, and I think he's a really interesting guy, but he really, I know he kind of despises people who are fence sitters because he says they're sort of a he views them as sort of weak-minded individuals. But the thing is, I mean, people who are sort of who are in between. They're afraid to take a stand.
Yeah, I would say most Americans, honestly, or most white Americans have my position in that we could tell based on their movement patterns, right? They may give lip service that they support diversity because they know they have to say that, right? But how they live is they want to move in pretty much white neighborhoods. They want to send their kids to pretty much white schools. But there's a caveat. It has to be 100% white, and they don't freak out if there's, like I say, a Hispanic kid there, or there should be an Asian kid or something like that. They don't really care about that. And I think that's the position of most what I call normal white people that, you know, aren't political very much, but that's how their behavior show them to be. They're not by themselves real diversity advocates. You don't see a flood of white people wanting to, you know, live in the ghetto.
Or some of those people that, or they're like that in their own lives, but they, for other people, they expect other people to, upper class people are like that, but at the same time, like, they'll support a busing for public schools.
Right. And it's kind of a social proof for the upper class people because they can claim that they love diversity and do all these liberal causes and feel good about it, where they don't live with diversity and they never associate with diversity. Well, they may have like a token black friend that's inoffensive or something like that, but that's their exposure to diversity. It's not the lower and middle class whites that actually have to face the violence and all that type of stuff. So it's easy to be for something when you don't have to live under it.
So before we move on to the next topic, is there anything else you'd like to add about this one?
No, I know it's a controversial topic, and I wanted to put that out there because sometimes people get confused about what I am and who I am, and I don't ever want to confuse people because I do a lot of satire and stuff, and I'm not a political leader, and I'm not trying to lead a movement or anything. It's just a guy with a camera, and I'm not really this racial white nationalist or anything like that. So if they think I am, they'll be very disappointed. But at the same time, I'm for our people having the ability to have self-determination.
Well, you say your definition of nationalism is two things, that a people have a right to exist and a right to self-determination. How do you define self-determination?
Well, yeah, those two things. An example is like Japan, right? And let me use a non-white country so it doesn't create that emotion of being white, because we've been so conditioned to think of anything white as wicked, right? So I'll use Japan as an example. I think most people realize that Japanese have the right for Japan to be Japanese, and that means that it can determine their own future, their own politics, their own culture. And now let's say, and I've used this example, if a few Mexican people wanted to move to Japan and marry some Japanese businessman, would it really hurt their culture? No, I mean, they would probably allow that. But at the same time, I think Japan's like 95 or 96% ethnically Japanese, so that's not a threat. But now if you had, let's say, 5 million Mexicans moving into Japan, and let's say in Japan, Tokyo now, in the public schools, 90% of the kids were no longer Japanese, they were Mexicans. That's a form of genocide. That's what's happening. Then you're wiping out a people in their nation, in their country. And that's really what's happened to our country. And that's what I'm opposed to. So, and if you no longer can have that majority, you can't control your way. You can't vote enough. And the people, the culture marxists, are gleeful about that in the United States. They're kind of like, oh, yeah, good luck. You guys, the Republicans may win this year, maybe or maybe not, but in a few years it won't matter because Texas is going to flip. It's going to be Democratic because of so many Mexicans.
Oh, like the Tim Weiss piece when the Republicans won.
Sure, yeah, because they look at it that way of like, pretty soon you won't have self-determination. You white people won't be able to decide things on your own anymore. That's their goal, and they laugh about it. They're excited about that. It gets them all excited. And I'm opposed to that. I think we should be able to have a country somewhere where we're able to determine our own self-determination. But at the same time, I'm not trying to say, because historically America was never 100% white, I don't advocate that we should aim for 100% white country or nothing. You know, I think something in between is a little bit more rational, is more a little bit more politically feasible.
I think regular people would respect that position. I think the thing is, the people who are the most vocal are, you were saying, the people who want 100%. Or on the other side, you have like the Tim Weiss types. those people are the most vocal, so they get all they tend to get what people think of, because the people who are in the middle don't really like to talk about these things.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, that's what I was going back to, is I think I agree with you completely, but I mean, someone like I mentioned, like Metzger, he's sort of more of a vanguardist type, who he probably would say that it should be 100%. But he does, when he says that the people in the middle are kind of weak-minded, I do think people like Metzger have a legitimate point, because they're kind of, people need to, at the same time, people need to grow a backbone and not be scared to speak out about stuff.
Right, and I think advocating 90% is not really being wishy-washy in the culture. I think a lot of people would say, wow, your idea is pretty radical, you know, so, but yeah, it's just so interesting how that is. And you're right, I'm not a vanguardist. I'm more of a, it's kind of like the Marxists. They had the revolutionary Marxism that failed in this country, then they had their cultural Marxism that actually worked. I consider myself more like a cultural nationalist versus a revolutionary nationalist, which some of those guys are, where they think that, oh, we got to wait till the whole system falls down, then we'll take the streets and be like Germany in 1933 again, and we'll have the brown shirts and we'll win. Yeah, I don't buy that. That's going to happen in America. If we're going to change things, we need to become part of the culture. We need to get our ideas out there. We got to kind of be normal people that fit in with normal, you know, instead of wearing costumes and saying let's wait for the revolution and all that. I don't buy into that. I don't think that's effective for this country.
So are you voting for Romney?
Yeah, it's irrelevant where I live. I live in Oklahoma, and he's going to win the state no matter what. There's only a few key battleground states based on how the electoral college works in this country, so he's going to win Oklahoma no matter what. But I do support Romney in the sense that I don't buy into this whole idea of, you know, worse is better. Usually worse is just worse. Better. And I know they think, oh, this gets so bad and there's going to be this revolution. Well, you don't know that, and the revolution may not be good for you. It could even be worse. I think we need to really get involved with the system and just present our ideas of we have a right to exist and we have the right to self-determination. It doesn't mean we hate other people. And by the way, that message I've given, people of all races have said, you know, I really respect that position. I understand that. That really makes sense. Unlike these kooks that are, you know, trying to get rid of everyone else. And so I think that's the way that we can be more successful with it, in my opinion. And again, I'm not political, so I'm not running for office, and I would never run for office because I don't have that ability to do the right kissing of the butt. But I think that's just the way that it will be successful.
I personally think who gets elected is totally irrelevant. I mean, I don't really agree with you. You have legitimate points about people who say worse is better. Obviously, like, the situation in South Africa disproves that, but at the same time, I mean, both candidates are pretty horrific.
Yeah, and really, the cultural Marxist, they went through the same problem with the Democrat Party. They were like, oh, man, they're not radical enough for us. We should just form our own parties. And, I mean, let's stick it to the man. People that are not old enough don't remember that, but that's how it was back in the 60s. And they had a component back then of the left-wing hippies that, let's make bombs, let's make a, you know, revolution. I think they were involved with Patty Hearst. Remember, they kidnapped her? And there was – people don't remember the anti-government types used to not be on the right. They were on the left, and that failed miserably because no one supported it. And so the ones, people like Norman Lear, they were like, yeah, yeah, the Democrats really aren't perfect, but they more support our values. Let's work with them and see how we can change things. And
yeah, I mean, Norman Lear is someone who was – obviously he's a terrible person, but he's had a bigger influence on culture than those other people did.
Definitely, and I you're right. I think he's a horrible person politically, but I admire his the way he went about it, across that average people could laugh at and start to influence their opinions, versus, you know, standing on a street corner with a blowhorn saying, you know, let's kill the police pigs and power to the people, revolution and all that sort of stuff. They did try that, by the way. There was a whole element that was involved with that sort of thing, and it failed miserably, just like it's failing on the right now. The FBI infiltrated them all, did a lot of buzz. People would try to make bombs and they'd blow themselves up, and normal Americans would laugh and cheer about that. And so people, at least in this country, do not support that revolutionary notion of let's, you know, hide out somewhere in the boondocks, get a bunch of weapons and wait to the end to come, because it's usually not going to come that way. How you make changes is get involved with the political process, and even though it's not perfect, but that's how you start the process.
There's the vanguardist solution, which you said is the people who advocate like revolution, and then there's the a lot of people who've tried to like dabble in electoral politics and try to run for office, and that seems kind of a hopeless. But I think the best thing that people can do right now is sort of what you pointed out, Norman Lear, as trying to influence culture. I guess the term for that is metapolitics, but using satire is definitely the most effective form of that.
Well, it happened on the right, too, fairly recently in the early 80s with the Christian right, which I wasn't a part of, but they had really no voice in either the Democrat or the Republican Party. And in the early 80s, they really got involved, focused on the family in some groups, and they started to support people specifically in the Republican Party. And they gained a lot of power and influence in the party that way. And even they had different camps. They had one camp, let's just keep out of politics and wait for Jesus to come and the rapture. But there was another group that actually went in and made the difference. And I think that's how it's going to happen for our people, is people need to get involved and they need not so much run for president of the United States. I know that's sexy, but they need to start at a local level and just get to in the local office and support candidates that support kind of a normal position people can buy into. Just even some moderate stuff like, you know, maybe black mobs that attack whites, they should be prosecuted and we should not sweep that under the rug, and just stuff that I think most people could really agree with. And you start slowly like that and you can really gain some traction, but it really starts at a local level before you start running for president. Now, that's just stupid, kind of silly theater. You're not going to win that. You got to start local and build your base.
And that's the thing with all these people. It is considered kind of sexy to run for president, and while running for something on a low level is seen as kind of boring. And even if you look at someone like Pat Buchanan, if he really wanted to, he could have become like a congressman, but he kept running for president, and obviously he didn't succeed with that.
Yeah, and I don't like the system. We're a two-party system in this country, and I don't like it, but I look at it as like, it'd be like, for example, you're playing the game of baseball and you don't like the rules and you think, well, I don't like having to run to first base. I should be able to run second. You may not like it, but that's the rules we have in this country, and it's kind of hard to change those rules from the outside unless you have a revolution. And again, unless we're in a really bad situation that this country hasn't experienced in a couple hundred years, you're not going to have probably a revolution. We're not like a South American country or Africa or something like that where there's a history of coups and stuff. And most Americans really don't have a patience for that type of thinking anyway, of bomb throwing or hitting the streets. They don't want that. They just want stability. They want to, you know, take care of their families. They want to provide for their futures. And they're concerned about politics, but they're not interested in anything that's too revolutionary or scary.
The thing is, most people in America still have it relatively, they have too much to lose. Like, they have jobs and they have this sort of entertainment culture. I guess in countries where you've seen revolution, there are places like where most people have been in poverty. But I don't, the people who, a lot of the, even a lot of the Alex Jones types or Patriot Movement types believe in the talk about this big collapse, but I think it's more of the frog in the boiling pan theory.
Yeah, I don't really believe in the end of the world type of people, because I've heard it all my life, even when I was a kid in the 70s. You know, Christians, I was told, well, we'll never hit 1980. The rapture will happen first. From the people on the left is like, well, we're never going to live, you know, we're never going to make it to the 1990s because we're going to have a thermonuclear war. It's 1 minute to midnight. We had all these scientists, 1 minute to midnight. We're all going to die unless we disarm. And, you know, we had all this hysteria back then, actually, in the 70s. You had the global cooling. And so all these people are always having these end of the world scenarios on the left, on the right, everywhere. But guess what? I mean, every day the sun comes up and the world goes on. So it's rare for that to have a really huge breakdown. Sometimes it has happened in countries, and in those situations, you can't have a revolutionary environment like the Russia, but that was during the World War One, and it was a very horrible time for them, so it was prime for a revolution, or Germany in the early 30s because of the hyperinflation. But in stable or fairly stable countries, and I don't count 10% inflation to be hyperinflation, you're not going to have that revolutionary spirit because people aren't willing, as you said, to risk all that for a revolution. So you got to work with the people, and you got to be somewhat reasonable and not have absolute positions. You can have an absolute position if it makes you happy, but it has no influence in the real world.
And I think a change happens gradually. Problem is, a part of it's our culture. People expect instant gratification, but it's the same with people involved with these different movements. They get frustrated if change doesn't happen. And I mean, the situation now is, it goes both ways, obviously. The change sort of happens gradually, so that applies to the sort of negative trends we're seeing in that sort of the frog in the boiling pan theory, but also with a positive change, it's something that sort of happens over time. And in some cases, change happens quickly, but that sort of people sort of try to take that for granted.
Right. And I was on another show, and I always bring this up. I'm a very much an optimist. I'm not a doom and gloom person. I think things will get better, and I think eventually we will. It's our destiny to have a homeland, and we will, and we'll one day go to the planets and the stars. I really believe that. So there's always been very tough times in history, and really what we consider now is a tough time is laughable. I study history, so this is nothing compared. Some people, after the fall of Rome, for example, that really was like a Mad Max scenario where because of the plague, a whole city would die, and they didn't have enough people to bury everyone. It was just horrible. So we really got it easy compared in historical terms. And I think we'll work out of this. And I think it's just, you know, we're going through a process right now. We need to do that. And I see more and more people that agree with nationalism. They may not use that word, but they really agree with the concepts. It's much more than 10 years ago. People are really waking up. So I'm encouraged.
Well, people do have it. Part of the reason is because people have it easier than they did in those times in the past. They're more tolerant of bad things. When people have it bad, they're maybe going to be less tolerant.
Right. And most people, all they want to do is kind of live their lives, really. I mean, they just want to provide for the families and maybe fall in love, and, you know, they have enough money to buy stuff. And that's really what they care about. And they don't really care that much about the political system as long as it doesn't impact them too much in a negative way, to be honest. They're not very political people, and especially Americans. We're not in generally political, ideological people. We've always been more of a practical people of what works. And so any strong ideology, if it's on the left or the right, just doesn't really catch on like it would in France or something like that. We just don't have that history.
And that's why in elections, the economy is always the big issue with people. And because that affects – people are just looking out for things like providing for their family and what affects their own pocketbook. That's why that's always the big issue. So if any kind of let's say like a nationalist movement or what any kind of movement talks about taking power, I think they really they have to really take into account economic issues just as much as because all that other stuff is your average person is that they don't well, your average person doesn't really care about stuff like abstract ideologies, especially Americans. They care about getting a paycheck.
Exactly. And they do care about crime and stuff. I think the average American is concerned, for example, about, and it's mostly like black or Mexican crime, they worry about that. But they don't worry about some abstraction like, oh, that girl down the street, she's, you know, 25% Japanese. That upsets me. They don't think about that. They really don't. You know, they don't lose sleep over that. They may worry about flash mobs. They may worry about, you know, oh boy, there's a lot of gangsters with saggy pants out there causing problems. That's what they worry about, and they want those people eliminated, either arrested or moved out or in a different country. But they worry about these theoretical abstractions that people like on Stormfront will have a 75-page debate about and end up – some of those debates were hilarious. They even said that Hitler's policy was way too left-wing. He just allowed too much race mixing. So it was
the Nuremberg Laws.
No, no, it was they were saying that he was I don't, you know, who knows who's trolls, but he was because he allied with Japan, you know, and how could a white man do that, you know? So it was hilarious. But in the real world, the non-freaks, we don't worry about that sort of stuff. We worry about, we want to live in a safe neighborhood. We don't care about, let's say, even a 90-year-old black lady doing knitting. No one cares about, right? You just want to be people that leave you alone and not cause trouble. That's what the normal Americans worry about. So in order for a nationalist movement to gain successful, it needs, first of all, to get our ideas out there to become mainstream and not seem freaky, right? Because most people are okay with an idea of, yeah, we want to live in neighborhoods that are safe and are, don't have crime, and we can speak our mind, but we're not going to worry about these abstractions that you guys are, you have all these endless debates about. That doesn't really, people in normal America don't care about that.
So I guess the other topic we can cover is this post you did called Virgin for Sale. So there is this student, this girl in Brazil is auctioning off her virginity to raise money for underprivileged families.
Yeah, I wonder how they know she's really a virgin too. That's interesting.
But, yeah, because I know there was another case where this was in the America where. This girl auctioned off her virginity at one of the brothels in Nevada, but even she admitted, or she said, oh, she's done other stuff, but I guess the doctors checked her hymen, and her hymen was intact.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. But what I was saying on that, I think, video is mostly guys prefer, at least for long-term relationships, women that haven't had a high sexual count. So the women that do that are just hurting themselves. Like, you know, guys like sluts. That's always the feminist myth that guy. I mean, most guys like, yay, girls are sluts, especially if they're pretty. They're for that, but they just don't want to marry or get hooked up long-term with one, right? Obviously, for obvious reasons. So it's in the woman's interest to be as chaste as possible. And also, statistically, women that haven't been with many guys tend to stick with their husbands or their mates or long-term relationships much better. You know, if a woman has slept with 50 guys, she's probably not able to bond with one guy anymore. And so as a guy, you'd have to be foolish to hook up with a woman like that and commit your resources to her, especially given our marriage laws against men and all that. Divorce is best not to get involved with those type of women. So that was kind of my point of that video, that, you know, still a high price she's doing if she does sell that. It's kind of a shame because men really do value women that are chaste or virtuous.
So what is this sort of what's the take on it? You talk about the sort of the attitude that the feminists have, where they think that no behavior, they're sort of against shaming any behavior. Behavior among women, not among, it's okay to shame a male behavior, of course.
Right. Yeah, and I think shame's good. Shame is healthy in a society. It helps promote good behavior, and that's one of the, in a free society, that's a very effective tool, because
yeah,
people,
because it's better. The problem is when there's no boundaries and people do whatever they want, then you get the situation today where you end up having a police state coming in, because that's sort of, I think, one of the things that happened is there was this big kind of decline in people's behavior, but people then what happened is the police state came in, and you have the government dictating people's personal lives, and that's sort of that's what ended up happening.
Well, yeah, and we changed the laws that years ago, if a man should have sex with a woman outside of marriage and she should get pregnant, he had no financial responsibility towards her, and she would really be shamed in the community, and she'd probably quietly give the child up for adoption. So that had a huge impact on how people lived their sexual lives, and women were a lot more careful. Right now, we kind of artificially changed that, is women that behave that way. I just saw that. Have you ever heard of that Honey Boo Boo? Ever watched that or something like that?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's really kind of a trashy show, but this big old obese lady, she has four different babies. She's white, by the way, so I'm not making a racial.
That's really her name?
That's her nickname. Her name, I forget her name, but her daughter's name she calls Honey Boo Boo. They're Southerners, and they kind of make fun of white people, but she has four kids from four different baby daddies, and that type of behavior wouldn't have been possible years ago because no one would have supported her offspring, and that would have changed her behavior. She wouldn't have acted in that way. So now we subsidize that behavior, so we get that those types of consequences. So yeah, subsidize that, it would radically change our society and how things work. Because in a free society, there's an assumption like, well, you know, if we're not married and you get pregnant, that's your problem. And because it was their problem, that really changed the sexual morality and how people responded to each other.
So it goes back to the what you were saying about those other issues is about the they should have the freedom to do what they want in the bedroom, but they sort of they want their cake and eat it too. And I guess like you talk about. Some of these lower class women who are single moms, you talk about how they have children, but the other thing is a lot of women like they want to find like a nice guy to take care of them when they're in their 30s.
Yeah, we have a situation that's perverse. We have the wrong incentives. We basically, the lower class people of any race are the ones, and they're lower class, they're usually lower class because they're stupid, a low IQ, and they're the ones that pump out the babies, right? So we're creating a whole race, not necessarily race, meaning white or black, but just in general, of really dumb people. Meanwhile, the smart people are having very few children, hardly enough to replace themselves, and they're not because through their taxes, they're supporting all these people that are pumping out these babies. So we got a system that's just totally backwards. We should reward the smarter people to have children, and we should punish the lower class people that keep pumping out babies. I've always advocated if you want to have a child out of marriage, that's your business. No one cares. And as a society, we'll care enough to care for your child. You can get welfare if you want for your first child. But if you want welfare for that child, you have to agree to be sterilized. I think we talked about that before. Because that would eliminate a lot of that. But right now, we have these weird incentives. The more babies you pop out, you either get more child support, especially if you do it for a different man. And if you don't get child support, we'll say daddy's in jail, you get government help then. And so these women, these trashy women, they can make a whole career out of making babies. And these are the kids that are going to end up themselves making more babies or end up in jail. So we got a weird system that we need to flip around.
Back to the original topic, can you kind of go into detail about how does this tie in with girl auctioning off her virginity?
Well, it's just a sad situation of people. I used it more to understand how important sexual restraint is in actually keeping a society together. So, and the reason we allow the sexual immorality to happen is we finance it. If we didn't finance it, that would reduce it quite a bit, right? Because right now people can do this and they know the state will bail them out. And if the state wasn't there to bail them out, their behaviors would change radically.
But that's just the thing with the state is that's mainly among the underclass. You see this kind of behavior among the middle and upper classes as well.
Yeah, but the middle and upper classes, because they have a more of a future orientation, to be honest, they can deal with it better. Upper class women, they usually can deal with their birth control better, and the upper class men or middle upper class, they can say, oh, you know, I better wear protection. I don't want to get stuck with 18 years of child support, right? Because they're smart enough, they have that future time orientation, which is one of the reasons they are middle, upper to middle class, because when they were in school, they would say, oh, I need to study for this test instead of, oh, well, it'd be more fun to, you know, drink or, you know, smoke this doobie and forget about studying. So they have a longer term time orientation, so they're able to better deal with that than the lower class. For the lower class, it's an absolute disaster because they don't have that orientation that they can think that far in advance. So they just do whatever feels good at the moment, and then it has long term consequences that other people have to try to clean up and that we subsidize. So that's really the problem. The upper class can get away with it a little easier because they're smarter, to be honest.
There's the issues of the having children, but then with that girl in Brazil you were talking about, you were more talking about her. You think it would harm her future prospects?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it will harm her in the future to be able to bond with this one man. The more women, and this has been studies, it's scientific, but the more men they've been with sexually, the harder there is, the more difficult it is to bond with a man. And sex is important. Sex is kind of the glue of a relationship. And it's kind of like that, a tape, right? Masking tape. It's how it's sticky. But if you keep reusing it more and more, it loses its, stickiness. Is that a word, stickiness? But you know what I mean. It doesn't stick as well anymore. And that's the same way with sex. At first, it's a really good adhesive and it can keep a couple together. But if you use it with all different places, like the masking tape, pretty soon it no longer works as a factor to keep people together. It loses its stickiness.
So the next thing we can cover is you did a video called The New Declaration of Independence. And it's based on this video that came out of France, and the video is, you can explain what it's about. It's against genocide and for self-determination.
Yeah, it's a great. Someone sent me a link to that video that these French kids put together, and is about how they have a right to self-determination, their French culture, and how they're losing it. And I looked at it, and I was like, wow, it's just like pure Ramsey Paul. These guys are great. They're not ashamed of their heritage. They're speaking out. They have a right to exist. And it was so cool. And I decided to do a video like that for Americans. Actually, I had to think about it for a while because I didn't want to make it into a parody, which would be easy to do. Usually I do parodies. And I didn't want it to be silly, but I wanted to keep that same.
Yeah, because most of your videos, you're making fun of other stuff rather than
right,
this is something
exactly.
That you support.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to do it so I'm not making, you know, I could have easily done it as a parody and dressed up, you know, like a striped shirt with a beret and a cigarette smoke and make it look like a French, you know, thing. But I decided, no, I just wanted to do it because I really respect what they did. And I wanted to do something for the Americans. And so I took the same theme and I wrote it really quick, but I just put it together. And it's actually one of my personal favorite videos I've ever done. So I was really happy with it. It turned out well. Because a lot of videos I do, and then I look, and yeah, I enjoy it, but I don't look at them again. And this video I looked at, I'm like, wow, I really like that video. I agree with what that guy's saying. Then I'm like, oh, well, that's me. That's why. But I really liked it. So I that's one of my favorite videos.
And I guess the other one we can touch on is you did one, single women in politics.
Yeah, that's the problem. And single women tend to vote with the herd, right? And then once they get, which in this case is Democratic, because that's the media tells them to do. But once they marry, it's interesting, they tend to vote as their husbands do, which was really one of the arguments against having the 19th Amendment, the women's suffrage, is that there's really no need to have it because their vote is done to their husband. And if you have a good society, they shouldn't be splitting their votes anyway. They should be voting as a family. And it's a proper position of the husband as the head of the household to do the voting. And we kind of see that anyway that happens typically, is that couples tend to vote the same way. And women, they tend to vote left-wing before they're married. But once they're married, they tend to vote more right-wing or more in line with their husbands, which is natural. Because women naturally, when they're in love with a man, start to adopt his positions and so forth.
Well, before I wrap it up, is there anything else you'd like to say to our audience?
No, I really appreciate being on here again. That was a good topic, and I had a lot of fun. So thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for being on. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.